Welcome to Exploring Your Creative Genius. Your host, Carl Nordgren, will teach you how to take an expansive view on what it means to be creative and entrepreneurial. Carl is an entrepreneur, novelist, and a lifelong student. For 20 years, he has been learning how to help folks grow their creative capacities. Now, here's Carl.
Hello, this is Carl Nordgren, and you're listening to Exploring Your Creative Genius on 97.9 The Hill, the best radio station in the state of North Carolina, 5 years running. This radio show, Exploring Your Creative Genius, is the show that believes that creativity is so important. It's so vital to each and every one of us to be our most creative selves that I refuse to define it for you, folks. I want you to come up with your own understanding of what it means to be creative. So on the show, I give you a lot of my thoughts about that so that you can pick and choose for what serves you best. Create your own situationally intelligent, dynamic understanding of yourself as a creative person. And I bring in a lot of guests so you can get their perspectives. I've had some good guests recently. About 2 weeks from now, I'm going to have Barry Gordy, the founder of Motown Records. His granddaughter is going to be a guest. So again, we've got some really awesome guests on the show. We've had some great guests. Today it's me, and today it's me challenging myself. If you've listened to the show with any regularity, I hope you see me as an optimist. I don't mind if even occasionally you see me as naive. But this first piece of research I'm going to share with you, which led me to the next two pieces of research, boy, it challenged my optimism about the human condition. And I didn't want to look away from it. I wanted to be clear-eyed in my understanding of what this tells us about us. It's how privilege can be so damaging when it shows up. It can be so very damaging. The first study, let's call it the car study, takes place out in California, where the pedestrian has all the right-of-way in a crosswalk. A crosswalk across the road, the pedestrian has the right-of-way. Cars, by law, should yield to the pedestrian in the crosswalk, entering the crosswalk, preparing to enter the crosswalk. So for this study, an observational field study, the researchers categorized automobiles in two very basic categories, luxury and less expensive. Less expensive is my 2005 Honda CR-V sitting out in the parking lot. Luxury, I think we all have a picture of what luxury cars are all about. And they engaged in hundreds of observations. They recorded hundreds of observations about what the car does as it approaches a crosswalk and sees pedestrians taking their right-of-way, applying their right-of-way. What does the car do? And again, the scale of expensive cars and inexpensive cars. 48% of the least valuable cars, the least expensive cars, 48%, just short of half, did yield the right-of-way to the pedestrians. I'll take just a second for you to guess what percentage of luxury cars yielded to pedestrians, gave them the right-of-way. 8%. 48% of the least expensive cars yielded, only 8% of the luxury cars did. And my initial gut reaction, I confess, is, oh, it's them. It's those privileged folk. Right? It's them. There's something wrong with them. Well, I couldn't be satisfied with that response, and so I did a little digging, and I found a couple other research projects. And the next one is the Cookie Monster Project. In this project, the participants are randomly assigned two roles in fake work scenarios. One role, some of the folks were assigned, was was sort of the high power boss in these work scenarios. The other role was a low power subordinate role. Members of both groups, each group, then read about two behaviors. One described somebody over-reporting on their travel expenses, spending 90 cents but claiming a dollar, a self-serving, unethical behavior. The other behavior that they read about was somebody stealing a bike, right? Even more blatant violation of codes of conduct. Later, as this research is advancing, a plate of cookies appears, And the researchers tell to the participants, hey, this plate of cookies isn't really for us. It's for another project. But sure, you see it now. Go ahead. You can take one or two when we're through. But please don't take very many because we have another project going on and we need cookies for the other project. So here's what was discovered when all of this was all over. The high status bosses, the people that were, again, randomly assigned this role, just people who were so they were in this role for just minutes. They had by far the harshest judgment on the unethical, immoral behavior of the folks described in these two behavior scenarios. By far the harshest judges versus the folks who were in the low power positions who showed some understanding and tried to show some grace in appreciating these folks. But here's the payoff. The folks that were in that high power boss role that were harshest in their judgments of others' behavior, they took on average twice as many cookies as the folks that were in the low power roles, right? So the sense of feeling entitled allowed them to ignore the request that was made and take what they chose, not what they were requested to take. So again, it's not that it's those people, it's us, depending upon the place that we see ourselves in. Here's another piece of research on that topic. It's built around a monopoly game. Two players in this monopoly game. One is, again, at random, right? No reference to their background, no reference to their education, nothing at all. At random selection, one of the players is given the privileged position of starting off with more money, of getting double the roll dices during the course of the game, of getting extra money when they pass go, of starting off, I think it was with two property titles before the game even began. And of course they won. And the one that people in that privileged position won the next time. They won every time because of this extraordinary privileged position that they had before the game even started. Well, post-game interviews with the players, the winners inevitably claimed their smart strategy as the reason for their victory, did not acknowledge at all their privileged start, and in fact were observed as the game went on, they became ruder, they became taunting, they started to gloat in the face of their competitor because they were winning so well, so conclusively. So power, wealth, it seems to erode empathy. It seems to erase empathy. It seems to provide a distorted self-awareness such that you don't even see how advantaged you are, one is, in these conditions. You don't even understand how advantaged you are in these positions. So that's, this research suggests, is all of us. And I hope that thinking about this will have some impact on us when we find ourselves in those privileged positions. We're going to break now, but we're going to stay on the topic when you come on back.
You're listening to Exploring Your Creative Genius with Carl Nordgren. Welcome back to Exploring Your Creative Genius. Here's your host, Carl Nordgren.
Welcome back. Thanks so much for coming back. Thanks for listening. Listening to Exploring Your Creative Genius on 97.9 The Hill. I'm Carl Nordgren. So I've talked about privilege, right, in the first episode, the three case studies of research about what happens when you're put in a privileged position. I feel very privileged to have the opportunity to be on this show. I have to use that word. Yes, I'm privileged to be associated with this radio station. It's such an awesome radio station. Well, having shared three research projects that have a little bit of a doom to them, right, a little darkness to them, that the human condition is so easily swayed by being given some advantage, I very quickly want to embrace that I deserve these advantages. That's not the best of our human condition, I don't think. So here, I went out and looked for something that might sort of give me put a smile back on my face, I sort of might mitigate what the conclusions are from these first projects. And I found one that comes pretty close. I found one that suggests that when people are in highly privileged positions, you can prompt them, you can prime them by giving them some sort of pro-social, some sharing prompts that will open them up to the fact that there's something going on beyond their privilege. The example that they used in the research summary that I found were physicians, doctors. And if doctors were talked to about the fact that they were experts, you'd get very different social behaviors than if you were to talk to them as about them being healers. And the example that they gave is that when you talked to doctors about being healers, their personal preparation for their work that they do throughout the day, something as basic as washing their hands, their 50%, 57% lift in how much they would wash their hands relative to the other group when they were prompted that this is who you are. You're a healer. You're here to take care of people. So there is a way, right, to modify, smooth off the rough edges or the hard edges of privilege by talking to the best of them, talking to the best versions of them. And I need to learn how to do that because I think that's important for us to help privileged people understand that they've got some blind spots when they live their privileged bubble life. So let's shift. Let's go from this privilege research. Let me quickly say, I'm privileged. I'm privileged in so many ways. I want to talk right now about how very privileged I am to be talking to you today, to be on this radio show, on this radio station on a regular basis. That's just the biggest privilege. I just want to celebrate that all the time. So now let's talk about humor. All right, let's go another direction, right? Instead of that darker side of the human condition, let's talk about the wonderfulness of laughter on the human condition. I would start all of my workshops, I start all of my workshops with a joke. From the very beginning teaching at Duke, I would start the first class of the first semester with a joke. And I did that. I came to understand why I was doing that. I didn't know right away from the beginning why I was doing that, but I came to understand why I was doing this. And my understanding fell into three different buckets. The first was I had a sense that humor would have the kind of impact on one's brain that I would like to have as we're getting ready to develop, explore our creative qualities. And so that's one. The second is that if I tell my joke effectively, if I've selected my joke effectively for this audience of 20 people, this group of participants, not an audience, this group of participants, if I tell the joke effectively and they laugh together, that means they've shared a laugh. Isn't that nice, right? So let's come back and talk about that in a moment. And then the third reason I would do it, and this really was anchored in my time at Duke, where I didn't want my Duke students to look upon me as a typical professor. I wanted to be seen as different in kind rather than different in degree. And so I start off by telling a joke, and I'm just going to be happy to appear like a foolish goofball, right? That's fine with me. And if that's a role that I take on that helps others be more open to what's going to come next, right, ready to take their own risks. So let's go back and talk about all three of this. There's a profound impact on the brain when you are told a joke, when you laugh at a joke, right? There's this incongruity of resolution in a joke. Boy, is that good for your brain when you're trying to get into a creative state, right? There's this violation of expectations and your prefrontal cortex, the logic center, it actually shuts down. It short circuits for a bit because of that challenge of that incongruity. It short circuits it a bit. And the limbic system, it lights up. The limbic system is the emotion system. You know, that lights up. So your brain is now in a state where it's much more conducive to creative growth, to new understanding, to creative challenges. So there's a reason why you'd want to tell a joke at the beginning of a workshop, a creativity workshop in particular. You shared a laugh. That was my second reason. That begins some bonding because that's an intimate thing to do, to share a laugh, right? You have to have faith and trust in the people around you for you to laugh in their presence. And if enough of you are laughing in each other's presence, again, it doesn't complete the bond, right? There's still work to do to create this as a group, instead of a group instead of a bunch of individuals. But it takes us in that direction, right, when they share a laugh. And then again, the third, the goofball part of me, again, just allows the people who are in that room with me to give themselves more permission for how they're going to behave in the course of this. And so here's the very first joke I would tell at the beginning of a semester at Duke University, starting back in 2002 when I first began to teach there. And it was a joke that my brother Bob, I'm pretty sure he composed this joke. I'm pretty sure he made it up. We were out in the woods. I'm 4 years older than he is. I was probably 10, 11. So do the math. He's you know, 7 or 8, somewhere in there, 6 or 7. And we're out in the woods. We always are. I'm with usually by myself. He's usually with a group of his friends. But we often overlap in our exploration and adventure in the woods. And we come out of the woods, and he says to me, in those days, I'm Bubba. He said, Bubba, I have a joke for you. I said, all right. He said, what did the snail say when he hitched a ride on the back of a turtle? I said, I don't know, Bob, what did a snail say when he hitched a ride on the back of the turtle? The snail said, wee! And in my class, I carry that wee on for even longer, and my arm is thrown up in the air, and my whole body is into that wee. And whether the kids in the class laugh at me or not, they now see that we're in a different place. This is a goofball in front of the room, and it's going to be a different kind of a experience here in this classroom, and that's what I'm trying to accomplish. And I'll tell you a couple more jokes when you come back from the break.
You're listening to Exploring Your Creative Genius with Carl Nordgren. Welcome back to Exploring Your Creative Genius. Here's your host, Carl Nordgren.
Welcome back. Thanks for coming back. You're listening to Exploring Your Creative Genius on 97.9 The Hill. I'm Carl Nordgren. In our previous segments, the first segment, I shared with you three research projects that indicate that when one is tempted to condemn folks who act selfishly from their privileged position, be careful, because research shows that if you were in that privileged position, it's quite likely you'd be acting the same way. It's not the people who get to the privilege, it's the privilege that distorts the behaviors of people. I then shared a research project that suggests that if you speak to these people who see themselves in privileged positions, and as you speak to them, point out the wonderfulness of what they do in this privileged position. Talk to doctors not as experts, but talk to doctors as healers. And the behavior that we get from that privileged position is much more healthy for the rest of us who the doctor is serving, is caring for. Then I started by talking about some jokes at the end of the second segment, and this segment is going to be all about humor, about what humor does to our brains, what humor does to our social environment. I shared the joke that my brother Bob made up. I'm going to tell a joke now that one of my granddaughters, Tilda, composed. Maybe a year before COVID, so she's 10 now. She must have been maybe 6 or so. She was sitting in the back seat of my car with her older sister, a couple years older. Solvi was in the car there, and we were telling each other jokes. And Solvi said, I've run out of jokes. I just don't, you know, I can't recall any more jokes. Tilda said, well, why don't you just make one up? I do it all the time. I said, oh, well, Tilda, I'd love to hear one of the jokes that you've made up. And this is the joke that she told me, and I'll play both parts. Knock, knock.
Who's there?
The chicken who crossed the road.
The chicken who crossed the road who?
The chicken who crossed the road to get to a better exit. And she said, get it, Pappy, get it. And I loved it, and I loved it, and I loved the punchline. But boy, what I really liked even more, maybe even loved even more, was the mashup of these two iconic joke structures. Are there two more iconic joke structures for children than knock-knock jokes and chicken who crossed the road jokes? And I had never in my life, I'm just turned 74, never in my life had I ever heard anybody mash those two joke strategies together like Tilda did. And so I laughed at the punchline, and I just really admired the strategy that led up to the punchline. So that's a joke from Tilda. The first joke was from Bob. This is a joke that I read. I can't credit this to a family member, but this is just, to me, such a funny, funny, funny joke. It's about three men who all just recently died, and they're up in heaven. All within the last day or two, they've passed away, and they find each other up in heaven, and they're talking about the fact that they've recently passed away, and they've talked about the fact that their funerals will be soon. And so they began to share what they would hope that the people who are looking at them in the casket, what sorts of things they would say about them. One of the persons said, "Boy, I hope when they look down at me, the conversation will be about how much I loved my family and how much I cared for my family and I sacrificed all I could for the well-being of my family. That's what I hope people will say about me when they see me in my casket." Another guy nodded and he said, yeah, I get that. But you know, what I really am hoping is I've invested a lot of my time in the local community. I cared for so many folks in my local community. I made those same sorts of sacrifices that you made for your family to my family as well. But I was also involved in as much community well-being as I could possibly be. I hope that's what they'll talk about when they look down at me in my coffin. The third person looked at the other two and said, "I know what I hope that they're going to say. I hope they're going to say, look, he just moved." I love that. I love that. We've got just one more minute left here, folks. You have probably heard the station has running a GoFundMe campaign. All that rain that we had a couple of weeks back did some serious damage on some of their broadcast equipment. And they are looking at a pretty good capital investment to get that repaired and replaced. And so they have a GoFundMe campaign going on. It's on the homepage. You'll find it on the homepage. They're making progress, but they're still in need of support. So I want to mention that. And in our very last minute, I'm going to give you one more tip. I don't know if I stress this enough. And that is, when you're working on a new idea, right, first coming up with a new idea for a poem, a new idea for a strategy, when you're in that very early stages and you're going to record, write down, capture the very first bit of it, don't do it on a keypad. Do it with a pen or a pencil in your hand working on a piece of paper. There's so much research. We've talked about research. Let's bring us back to the main purpose of the show, which is creativity. There's so much research that shows when you hold something in your hand, the aspects, the parts of your brain that are so important for creative cognition, they come alive in the way that they don't when you're just simply keyboarding. And I like to picture this. I haven't heard this in the research, but this is sort of my extrapolation. It's just as a pen or a pencil sort of imprints on the page, right? It makes an imprint on the page. Writing it also makes an imprint on your mind. I hope the show makes some good positive imprints on your mind. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you have an outstanding week. This is 97.9 The Hill, exploring your creative genius.
This has been Exploring Your Creative Genius on 97.9 The Hill. You can listen to other episodes on chapelboro.com.